BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now on 4 Extra, Hannah Gordon reads episode 4 of Martin Stannard's biography of Muriel Spark. Today, with fame and the commercial success of her novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, Muriel is acclaimed by the American press as a major author. But this success is the backdrop to an increasingly difficult family situation.
The prime of Miss Jean Brodie reached back to the root of Muriel's consciousness when it had been bounded by Edinburgh and Miss Kay. Sandy speaks of her mother, as Muriel did of Sissy in Curriculum Vitae, with wry humour rather than resentment, as an embarrassment, as flashy and overprotective. Muriel had returned to Brunsfield Place in December 1960 to write the novel in just 4 weeks while tuned in to Edinburgh Diction. Within a fortnight, it had been typed, corrected, and submitted. She'd given her parents some money, and they had left her alone with the silence she needed. Muriel's father, Barney, now retired, spent most of his afternoons watching televised horse racing. Her son, Robin, worked in a jeweller's shop, manoeuvring between his grandparents' flat and his father's. Sissy's instinct was still to chatter and to show her daughter off, overtures discouraged by Muriel, and particularly so on this occasion. She later wrote, "They had no idea, none of them, what it meant to be an artist, a writer. They didn't appreciate that side of my work, the artistic process. No idea whatsoever." Betrayal, partly the theme of Brodie, dogged Muriel's thoughts. It seemed to her that each break for freedom, for the liberty to write and to live her own life, engendered accusations from one group or another. Her new London friends, bright young acolytes like Oberon Waugh and Gillan Aitken, knew her only as a success. To them, she was a powerful figure, talented and confident. These charming, well-bred escorts, 20 years her junior, rejuvenated her in a way friends of her own generation could not. Muriel continued to be fearful of her family's intrusiveness. "When I should have bought property," she later reflected, "was then, but I simply couldn't, because I didn't know what my family's demands were going to be. I really felt, too, that if I had a house, I'd never get my family off my nut. They'd regard it as money in the bank for them. They'd expect me to raise money on it, or to rent rooms, or to do something for them." They, here, referred mainly to her mother. Her father was not a problem. Muriel was happy to accept limited liability. For years, she had been sending them money, currently a monthly cheque. In addition, she had offered to pay the household expenses, by which she meant bills for gas, electricity, television hire. These were sent to her accountant, who deducted the sums from her earnings. Then, she discovered that all bills, down to shoe repairs, were arriving. As her family's sole support, she felt exploited. Robin was 23, a grown man with a full-time job. Why, she wondered, did he not leave home and set up independently? She would write to friends about it, by turns cross and considerate, still hoping to rescue him from Edinburgh. Brodie was abstractly about how she rescued herself from it, with the help of Miss Kay. In the book, Sandy, like Muriel, was haunted by a spirit of repression in the city. Something shrouded its glories, wagging its finger. Its monolithic blackened buildings issued grim warnings. In their shadow, all efforts to be original or to escape were foredoomed. Perhaps it was only during the writing of her novel that Muriel identified what had driven her out. It was John Knox and Calvin. For Sandy, Calvinism was the unacknowledged other that she had to discover in order to reject it and to define herself. It is everything that the headmistress personifies and Miss Brodie opposes. Chilly team spirit, information as truth, education as indoctrination, fear of the unusual and the desire to crush it into conformity. Miss Brodie turns towards Europe, colour, light and air. She teaches her girls to think for themselves, to cultivate the Gioconda's composure. Her non-sequiturs dart past analytical logic towards poetry, drama, opera, the expansive gesture, metaphor. She has the artistic temperament. Her girls are her vocation. Education is a leading out, not a putting in. To put in is to intrude. She is another of those Sparkian heroines who dismiss their enemies, flattening their scorn beneath the chariot wheels of her superiority. Head up, up. Her bony opponents stalk past her in the corridor saying, "Good morning," with predestination in their smiles, inquisitive rather than questioning. Publication of Brodie in the UK was deferred to allow the New Yorker a free run on the 14th of October 1961. Muriel was the first British woman to receive their entire issue accolade. Suddenly, from having cult status and modest American sales, she had 430,000 readers and the imprimatur of the glossiest arbiter of American literary taste. Would this furore affect British sales? Unfortunately not. British reviews were generally good, but a surprising number were either baffled or unimpressed. Given the brilliance and durability of Brodie, the obtuseness of the British literary establishment in this case was astonishing. The Times dismissed it as a bundle of contradictions and not much else besides. There remained, of course, a host of admirers. Evelyn Waugh was still dazzled, enthusiastically waving her banner. As usual, she had sent him a copy. "All the book delightful," he replied. "The letter, genius." This was Sandy's and Jenny's composition, imagining Miss Brodie's correspondence with Gordon Lowther. "Allow me, in conclusion, to congratulate you warmly upon your sexual intercourse as well as your singing." One of the few sections primly cut from the New Yorker version. On the 12th of January 1962, Muriel touched down in New York to find that city ready for her in a way that London was not. Her American publisher, Lippincott, had booked her into the Algonquin, arranged parties, press interviews, dinners, and a trip to their Philadelphia headquarters. Brodie was published on the 17th to a crescendo of adulation. To celebrate, Lippincott threw a cocktail party at the St. Regis Hotel, where John Updike, W.H. Auden and Lionel Trilling paid homage amid the creme de la creme of literary journalists. This, at last, was celebrity and a form of redemption. Muriel was delighted and grateful. Among New Yorker writers, she quickly made friends with Shirley Hazzard, Dwight MacDonald, and the blind Indian writer Ved Mehta. Her Lippincott editor, Cork Smith, was young, but one of the best. A photograph of Muriel there reveals an astonishing transformation. She looks 20 years younger than she had in pictures taken just 5 months earlier. Her face is narrower, her eyes larger and more luminous. A translucence has emerged from the earlier square-set face, homeliness replaced by a modest yet knowing exoticism. She had become a star, not merely in name, but in her whole appearance. Then, the worst telephone call of Muriel's life arrived, and she rushed to Edinburgh to be with her dying father. Felled by a stroke, Barney was in the Royal Infirmary. When he asked why the rabbi didn't visit, she lied and said he had come while Barney was asleep, privately putting down his non-appearance to the fact that her father was too poor to merit attention. It was the Church of Scotland minister who helped him lay his bets on the horses. Then his condition deteriorated. He became delirious with palatal palsy, and any hope of recovery faded. On the night of the 21st of April, 1962, Muriel was jerked from sleep in her hotel bedroom by the telephone bell. A nurse was speaking. Her father was dead. Half dazed, she received the news dispassionately and walked to her window. In the darkness, the castle loomed. Back home again, having buried the dead, she wrote to one of her new American friends. My father's funeral was our first warm day. A man he did not like fell into his grave. Such coolness might be mistaken for insensitivity. In fact, the reverse was the case. There was no disguising the wound inflicted by this death. My father had more affection for me than anyone else. So that is gone, out of the world. I loved and miss him very much, she informed Shirley Hazard. Lots of family problems at the Mo, but they will dissolve with time. Knowing little of the religious requirements, Muriel left arrangements for the Jewish funeral to her brother Phil. Shortly after the ceremony, however, he'd had to return to America. It was then that the full force of the family problems came home to her. Her mother had a saying, "A son's a son until he gets a wife, but a daughter's a daughter all her life." Like her father, Muriel had a tidy mind. Her mother's affairs were chaotic. Unnerved, she wanted to become dependent on her vigorous daughter. Muriel was famous. She appeared to be rich. She would sort things out, take over where father had left off. Not if Muriel could help it. When she'd first arrived to attend her dying father, Muriel had stayed with Sissy and Robin. She was appalled by what she found. Her mother was drunk, the flat a shambles. Muriel got a bucket and a scrubbing brush, went down on her hands and knees and scoured to the kitchen floor. Muriel did the shopping and each day sat by Barney's hospital bed. At that stage, no one knew whether Phil planned to come over from San Francisco. He had been contacted, but had confirmed no arrangements. Then Robin apparently sent a wire. "Come immediately. Spare no expense. Mum will pay." That at least is how Muriel remembered the message. She was enraged, refused to pay. Her brother had an excellent job and had done little to support his parents. Everything, she felt, had fallen on her shoulders and would do in the future. She had no intention of subsidising him. In the event, Phil had acted independently and was embarrassed by Robin's telegram. But it was a sign of worse to come. Before Phil's arrival, Robin and Muriel had another argument. "You get out of here," she later recalled him saying. "You've got to go." Whatever may or may not have been said, that is how she came to be alone in the North British Hotel, sitting in a window seat as she contemplated love, death, and exile between visiting hours at the Royal Infirmary. She felt excluded from her childhood home, and shortly afterwards went to live in New York.
Despite finding happiness in Italy, the vexations of Sparks' family life intruded long into old age, as we'll hear when Hannah Gordon reads the final part of Muriel Spark, The Biography by Martin Stannard, at This Time Tomorrow. The producer was Kirstine Cameron. Michael Palin has written a daily diary since April 1969, which, as it turned out, was 1 month before the creation of Monty Python's Flying Circus. In it, he recorded the unvarnished truth about life inside the world's most influential comedy team.
For the historian's sake, I should probably have noted every detail of the birth of Monty Python. How could I miss the creation of the Spanish Inquisition and silly walks? But it seemed far more important to me to record the emergence of my new family, than the faltering steps of a comedy series that would probably last no more than 2 years. And that, I feel, is as it should be. Legends are not created by diaries, but they can be destroyed by them.
From The Holy Grail to The Life of Brian, The Michael Palin Diaries, The Python Years, starts next Monday afternoon at 3:15 here on Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and welcome. It's Alan Smith here on 4 Extra, where we're about to indulge ourselves in an hour of great drama. That's coming next. And then you can hear the next chapter of Abraham, Hannibal and the Battle for the Throne, the story of an African slave turned Russian military leader. You can hear what happens by joining Mel for that and much more in this afternoon's 4 o'clock show. Now it's time for the next part of the Carlingford Chronicles, Margaret Oliphant's humorous novel, which was published in 1866. It tells the story of Miss Lucilla Marjorie Banks, whose twin aims are to be a comfort to her father and to revolutionise society in Carlingford. Lucilla's revolution may be a success thus far, but Mr. Cavendish is causing ructions.
The Carlingford Chronicles by Margaret Oliphant. Miss Marshbanks, dramatised for radio in 4 parts by Elizabeth Proud, with Elizabeth Spriggs as Mrs. Oliphant, Teresa Gallagher as Miss Lucilla Marshbanks, Paul Daneman as Archdeacon Beverly, and Keith Trinkle as Mr. Cavendish. Episode 2, Skirmishes.
The success of Miss Marshbanks' first evening was confirmed when Mrs. Woodburn and her brother, Mr. Cavendish, came to congratulate Lucilla and find out more about the wonderful contralto.
I suppose your unknown singer is professional.
Oh, I would never choose to have professional singers for my part. You have to give yourself up to the music, then, and that is not my idea of society. For people who give one party in the year, it does very well. But then I hate parties. The only pleasure in society is when one's friends come to see one without any ado.
In white frocks? Hi!
Yes. I hate grand toilette when it is only a meeting of friends. I hope, Mr. Cavendish, you really thought it was a pleasant evening. Anybody can do a thing once, you know. The second and the third and so on. That is the real test. But I hope you thought it pleasant so far as it went.
It was a great deal more than pleasant. And as for your conception of social politics, it is masterly.
I went through a course of political economy at school.
For my part, I think you ought to be Prime Minister. Oh, and that contralto of yours is charming, raw material. But if I were you, I would put her through an elementary course. She knows how to sing, but she does not know how to move. And as for talking, she seems to expect to be insulted.
Oh, yes, poor Barbara. She is a little shy, but that will soon wear off. I don't see what need she has to talk, or to move either, for that matter.
So her name is Barbara?
Yes. I thought she did very well indeed for a girl who never goes into society. Was it not clever of me to find her? It has always been so difficult to find a voice that went perfectly with mine.
For my part, I think it was a great deal more than clever. It was a stroke of genius. I have a weakness for a fine contralto. I wonder if it would be indiscreet to ask where Mademoiselle Barbara comes from, or if she lives anywhere.
Ah, you may be sure now that I have found her out, I mean to keep her for myself. It's just time for lunch, and you're both going to stay, I hope.
The listener will have noticed that Mrs. Woodburn was uncharacteristically silent during this conversation.
It was the first time I had observed my brother and Miss Marshbanks together. It was clear that Harry's attentions to her were marked indeed.
Lucilla had been pondering the same subject.
Of course, my mission to reorganise society here is more important than anything else. But I could accomplish it just as well as the wife of the MP for Carlingford. I must take everything into consideration.
Quite. What she had not so far taken into consideration was Barbara's interest in Mr. Cavendish.